We have finally come to the seventh and last period of church history called the American Church. Now, as you will recall, the sixth period I called the Modern Church. And actually, all I did in that period was start with the modern era and go through England and Europe. So, technically, the American Church is part of the modern era, but there's so much to cover in the American Church period that I made it a separate division. In other words, these two periods overlap. So, we're going to discuss the American Church, beginning with the arrival of the Roman Catholics on Columbus's second voyage to America, and extend all the way down to the present. Now, there are a lot of topics that we're going to discuss. For example, I'm going to begin by discussing denominationalism, and then I'm going to discuss revivalism, and then foreign missions, the holiness movement, and I'm going to give some attention to church music in church history, but focusing primarily on America. Now, those are some of the topics that we're going to cover in this section. There are others, but that'll get us started. So let's start with denominations. And what I've done is pass out an outline that lists a number of denominations. And I want to go through these and hit the high spots of their significance. For example, let's start with Roman Catholicism. The earliest expeditions to America were conducted by the Spaniards. They were conducted by the people from Portugal and France. All of those people were Roman Catholics. So when they came to the United States, they brought their religion with them, which means they brought Roman Catholicism with them. So, for example, in 1513, when the Spanish explorer Ponce de Leon claimed Florida for Spain, he was one of the first to come to the New World, as it's called. In 1564, a group of Huguenots came to America and established a colony which is now near Jacksonville, Florida. Now, if you will remember, the Huguenots were Protestants from France. They were called Huguenots, but that's another name for French Protestants. So now we have Catholics in Florida, and we have the French Protestants in Florida. What is interesting is that the Spaniards went up and virtually eliminated the French Protestants. One claims that he hanged 142 of them, attaching to each one an inscription which read, "Not as a Frenchman, but as heretics." So they slew them, not because they were Frenchmen, but because, in their opinion, being Protestants, they were heretics. So the earliest church established in the North American continent is the Roman Catholic Church in St. Augustine, Florida. It was established in 1565. So before there was ever a single Protestant baptism in North America, there was the establishment of a Catholic church in St. Petersburg. By the middle of the 18th century, all the territory beyond the Allegheny Mountains was under French influence. The Southwest was ruled by Spain. The Roman Catholic Church was supreme. Only a narrow ribbon along the Atlantic coast was Protestant. At that point, it looked as if Catholicism would rule the continent. But the British conquest of Canada in 1759 and later the concession of Louisiana and Texas to the United States changed the balance of power in North America from Catholicism to Protestantism. So the Roman Catholic Church, even till this day, is the largest religious body in the United States and has the oldest continuous institutional existence. Nearly one in four Americans is a member of the Catholic Church. Living in Los Angeles, that's not hard to believe. Living in some other places in the United States, it is, but the simple reality is there are just a multitude of Catholics in the United States. What I think is interesting is they were here first. They established themselves with churches, and I guess you could say in the providence of God, the Protestants came along, or this could have been a Catholic nation. The next denomination I want to discuss are the Protestant Episcopal Church. The Church of England was the first Protestant church established in America. A service was held under Sir Francis Drake in California as early as 1578. So, the next big invasion was by the Church of England. In 1607, the Virginia Company in England settled in Jamestown, Virginia. Provision was made for the establishment of the Anglican Church. That's in Virginia, in 1607. In 1693, the William and Mary College was founded in Virginia. It was founded as an Anglican institution. Professors were required to declare allegiance to the 39 Articles of the Anglican Church, and students were required to be members of the Anglican Church. So we have a clear establishment of the Anglican Church. In 1702, despite the opposition of the Roman Catholics, the Anglican Church became the established church of Maryland. It also became the established church of South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia. This pattern did not change until the American Revolution. So the continent could have become Catholic, and the next thing is it could have become Anglican. Two-thirds of the signers of the Declaration of the Independence were Episcopalians. But the American Revolution almost destroyed the Church of England in America. At his ordination, every clergyman of the Church of England was required to take an oath of allegiance to the British crown. So when the Revolution broke out, the Church of England clergymen had to choose whether to flee to England or Canada, remain in the colonies as loyalists and face opposition, or break their vow of allegiance. At the close of the Revolution, many Episcopal clergymen left the country. So, the country could have become Catholic, and the country could have become Anglican. The next denomination I want to speak about is the Congregational Church. In 1620, 102 men, women, and children, called pilgrims, sailed for 2 months across the Atlantic in the Mayflower before reaching Cape Cod. It's been a while since I've been there, but if you go to Cape Cod, I assume it's still there. There's a rock that has 1620 etched in it. The landing of the pilgrims.
That's Africa?
In Massachusetts. No, in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Cape Cod in Massachusetts.
Okay.
All right.
1620.
All right. The pilgrims were English separatists. Now, you're going to have to remember back when we were discussing what's going on in England that the you know, Henry VIII kicked out the Catholic Church, established the Church of England. Then the group within the Catholic, the Church of England, wanted to purify it, get all the Catholicism out of it, and they were called Puritans. When that didn't work to everybody's satisfaction, a group arose called Separatists and said, we're never going to get all the Catholicism out of the Church of England, and they became Separatists, and they went to Holland, they went to Leiden, and from Leiden they sailed to America as pilgrims, and in 1620 landed in what is now Massachusetts. All right, so they were English Separatists who left England, lived for a time in Leiden in the Netherlands. They were Congregationalist. In fact, the Mayflower Compact was an extension of the covenant idea of the Separatist applied to civil government. I think this is most fascinating. When the Separatists broke away from the Church of England, they decided to bind themselves together with a covenant. A lot of churches through the years have had a covenant. Baptist churches have, for example. So have congregational churches. Well, on the Mayflower, they came up with the Mayflower Compact, and all they did is take that church covenant and apply it to government. And that's the Mayflower Compact. At any rate, the pilgrims came and established a theocratic government based on biblical law and Calvinism. This is New England. As the Church of England was the state church of Virginia, so the Congregational Church was established as the state church of Massachusetts and Connecticut. Are you aware that we once had a state church in America? In Virginia, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. Matter of fact, the Constitution says the federal government can't establish a state church. That's what all the fuss is about. Now they've used that amendment to say you can't do anything pertaining to the church, but that wasn't the intent. The intent was that there not be a state church. Well, there were state churches in the United States, or at least, matter of fact, as I recall, the State Church of Massachusetts and Connecticut were there until, I think, 1820-something. So even after the establishment of the country. Everyone was taxed to support the church, and only church members could vote. So the state church meant everybody in the state had to pay a church tax, whether they were a member or not. But you had to be a member in order to vote. Imagine telling people that today. It was not until 1888 in Connecticut and 1833 in Massachusetts where the church and state were separated, and the church finally had to support themselves. I said 1820 and looked in my notes, it's 1818 and 1833, but that's way past 1776. So there was a state church. All right. By the way, the Congregationalist founded Harvard University in 1636 and Yale in 1707 and Dartmouth in 1769. And they founded all those schools in order to train preachers. The Puritans did it, and they were mostly Congregationalists. All right? So, we've looked at the Catholic Church, the Episcopal Church, the Congregational Church. Now let's talk about the Reformed Church. This New York was first occupied by the Dutch as a trading post in 1613. It did not become a town with permanent settlers until 1623. The colony was first called New Netherlands. The city of New York was first called New Netherlands. I'm sorry, the state of New York. The city was called New Amsterdam. The first church was organized in 1628 under the name of the Reformed Protestant Dutch Church. It was the official church of the colony. In 1664, the colony was taken by Great Britain, renamed New York, and the Church of England became the state religion. But the Dutch Reformed Church was allowed to continue unhindered. In 1867, the word Dutch was omitted from the official title, and it became the Reformed Church in America. Now, while I'm discussing churches, let me just mention, the Reformed Church is not one that gets a lot of publicity. It's not as popular as, say, the Baptists, the Methodists, and the Presbyterians. So let me just tell you, there are four branches of the Reformed Church. The first is the one I just mentioned, the Reformed Church of America. You remember Robert Schuller down in Orange County, the Glass Cathedral? He was a member of the Christian Reformed Church. Now, there was a split, and the split was between the Reformed Church and a second Reformed group called the Christian Reformed Church of North America.
How about the first group?
The first was the Reformed Church in America, and the second is the Christian Reformed Church in North America. Then, by the way, when I was a young Christian, there was a very popular radio program called the Back to God Hour, and it was produced by the Christian Reformed Church. They're the ones that have Calvin College and Calvin Seminary in Michigan, I believe it is. All right, then there was another split, and it became, there's a third group of Reformed churches called the Netherlands Reformed Congregation in North America. That was founded in 1907. And still another split, and it was called the Protestant Reformed Churches in America, 1926. Now, I don't expect you to remember all that. I just thought I would throw out that the two main bodies of Reformed churches are the Reformed Church and the Christian Reform. And that's the way they're most known. All right, we're down to the Baptist Church. We are discussing denominations, and we are down to the Baptist churches. All right. The Baptists comprise one of the largest and most diverse groups of Christians in the United States. The First Baptist Church of America was established in Rhode Island. The story begins with Roger Williams. He graduated from Cambridge University and became an Anglican pastor. But he soon adopted separatist ideas. In 1631, he went to Boston and from there to Plymouth, Massachusetts, because he thought the Boston church had not purified itself sufficiently. In 1634, he was called to be the pastor of the Congregational Church in Salem, Massachusetts. At the time, the Congregational Church was the state church of Massachusetts. So, in 1635, the General Court ordered Williams out of the territory within 6 weeks because he upheld the Indian ownership of land, opposed the state church, and insisted that magistrates had no power over a man's religion. So they kicked him out. It was the fall, and he was in poor health. So they gave him till the spring to get out. But when he began conducting meetings in his home, they ordered him to leave immediately. So in the dead of winter, he's kicked out of Massachusetts, leaves his family and children in Salem, and for 14 weeks wandered in the deep snow in the forest. Finally, the Indians he had befriended in Plymouth took him in. In the summer of 1636, he purchased land from the Indians. His family and friends came from Massachusetts, and they founded the city of Providence, Rhode Island. In 1639, a church was founded in Providence, and all the members were baptized as believers by immersion, including Williams. This is generally considered to be the first Baptist church in America, and it is still there. Not the original building, but the First Baptist Church of Providence, Rhode Island is an American Baptist church, and it still operates.
Yeah, I went there.
Yeah, I've been there too. Right, very good.
Is it in Providence?
It's in Providence, Rhode Island. All right. I need to tell you that that's generally conceded that that was the First Baptist Church. But true to Baptist tradition, there is a conflict. There's a Baptist church in Newport, Rhode Island, and one in Providence that still disputes over the title of the oldest Baptist church in America. So there are other churches that claim they were first. You know, you have to be a Baptist to appreciate that. All right. After 3 or 4 months, Roger Williams disassociated himself with the church in Providence. He decided that perhaps the religion of the Indians was as acceptable to God as was Christianity, and they didn't have to become Christians in order to be saved. Roger Williams eventually concluded that all churches were false and that the Bible was to be understood purely in spiritual terms, whatever that means. Incredible. When the government of Rhode Island was set up in 1647, among other things, it was founded on the separation of church and state, and the complete freedom of religion. By the way, Henry Dunster, D-U-N-S-T-E-R, was the first president of Harvard College, now Harvard University. That gets interesting in a minute. Baptists did not flourish in New England. They flourished in Rhode Island and other places, but not New England, because of persecution. If you were remember, Massachusetts has a state church. So if you didn't worship according to the state church, you were fined, arrested for holding a religious meeting in your home, as was the case in Lynn, Massachusetts. And the authorities were irritated because the three men preached against infant baptism. One of them received 30 lashes. One was fined £20, which was half a year's salary. And the third was fined £5. So there was persecution. Holmes, the one that was beaten so badly that for weeks he was not able to allow any part of his body to touch his bed. He had to lie on his knees and elbows. He was so severely beaten. In 1533, realizing it would cost him his job and his status in the community, Dunster refused to have his infant son baptized. Remember, he's in Boston, he's in Harvard, and he's president, and there's a state church. And he refused to have his son baptized as an infant, his baby. So he was indicted by the grand jury for disturbing the ordinance of infant baptism and sentenced to public admonition. He was compelled to resign his office as president of Harvard. So the first president of Harvard was a convinced, converted Baptist. Wow. In the middle of the 18th century, the Baptists were persecuted in Virginia. A prosecuting attorney said to a judge, "May it please your worship, the men are great disturbers of the peace. they cannot meet a man on the road, but that they ram a text of Scripture down his throat. End of quote. Those charged were imprisoned. In prison, they preached every day from the window to the crowd which assembled to hear them, and many were converted. Baptists flourished in Pennsylvania and New Jersey because those colonies offered religious freedom. Now, I said we're talking about denominations, but I need to clarify, there's no such thing as a Baptist denomination. Rather, Baptist churches in Pennsylvania and New Jersey held joint meetings to administer baptism, ordain ministers, and provide inspirational preaching. In other words, they got together, but they didn't have a denomination. If you know anything at all about Baptists, you know every Baptist church is independent. Decisions were made by an association of Baptist churches, but they weren't binding on individual churches. The associations and later conventions were established to carry on educational and missionary work. So Baptist churches got together and said, we'll band together so we can have a seminary to train preachers and we can send missionaries. So that's how the Baptists got together. In 1688, there were only 13 Baptist churches in all of North America. By the mid-19th century, there were upwards to 13,000. Baptists multiplied like the proverbial rabbit. Baptist pastors in general adapted themselves to the conditions and habits of the people, and that is what some say contributed to their rapid growth. Baptists founded one of the first colleges in America. They wanted to train pastors, so in 1764, they founded what is now Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Prior to that, they had established Harvard and Yale. So the Baptists were one of the first to establish a college. Brown is the third oldest college established in New England. Baptists fought for the separation of church and state. Only one Baptist, John Hart, spelled H-A-R-T, signed the Declaration of Independence. But when the Congregational Congress met in 1774, Baptists were on hand lobbying from the outside to get religious liberty included in the discussion. A Baptist preacher named Isaac Bacchus, B-A-C-K-U-S, pointed out to Samuel Adams that the Massachusetts taxation of Baptists to support a state church. Now remember, everybody in Massachusetts had to pay a church tax, whether they were a member of the state church or not. So he argued that for Baptists to have to support the state church was just as unjust as the British taxation of the American colonies, which is what the Revolution was all about. So, on another occasion, he argued, all Americans are alarmed at the tea tax, though, if they please, they should avoid it by buying the tea. But we have no such liberty. That is, we have to pay the church tax. If you object to the tea tax, just don't buy the tea. But you can't get out of the church tax. Thought that was just a very fascinating argument. So, Baptist were also mission-minded. The mission story starts with Adoniram Judson, who was the son of a congregational pastor. After graduating from Boston University and Theological Seminary, he was ordained as a congregational minister. Partly a result of his persuasiveness, the Congregationalists formed a mission society. In 1812, he and others sailed from Salem, Massachusetts, to Asia to become congregational missions. On the voyage, he translated the New Testament, a project he had started in seminary. His translation work convinced him that baptism was to follow conversion and that it had to be by immersion. So, when he and his wife reached India, they were baptized and declared themselves Baptist. Another congregational missionary on the trip, Luther Rice, also became a Baptist. They resigned the as congregational missionaries and sought support from Baptist churches. Now, there's a long story here, but Luther Rice got sick and had to come back home. So he couldn't go back to the mission field, so he spent his life raising support for Judson and went to Baptist churches, and eventually they formed a missions society. The Baptists split over slavery. Matter of fact, this is an interesting story. The Alabama Baptist Convention voted to withhold funds from the American Baptist Foreign Mission Society and from the American Baptist Foreign Bible Society until they could be sure that these agencies had no connection with the abolitionists. Otherwise, they threatened to form a Southern board. The Georgia Baptist Convention deliberately created a test case presenting to the House, the Home Mission Society, a missionary candidate that was a slave owner. The board voted 7-5 against his appointment. So, in May of 1845, the Baptists of the South met in Augusta, Georgia, to organize the Southern Baptist Convention. They split over slavery. The churches in the North, sort of by default, became the Northern Baptist.
So the Southern Baptist in favor of slavery?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was the point. You could be a slave owner and be a member of the Baptist Church in the South. Yes. That was 1845. The Northern churches didn't get organized until 1907. A few years ago, there was a pastor of the First Baptist Church of Burbank who was 100 years old, and he'd been pastor of that church for 70 years or something. Do you remember his name?
Grandview.
Who?
Grandview,
First Baptist of Glendale.
Is it?
I was told.
The daughter is still here.
I was told he was in the 1907 meeting. He died a few years ago. All right, they formed the Northern Baptist Convention in 1907. In 1922, rather than adopt a formal creed, the Northern Baptist Convention overwhelmingly voted to affirm, quote, that the New Testament is the all-sufficient ground for our faith and practice. We need no other statement, end of quote. That's very Baptist. However, in 1933, the General Association of Regular Baptists split from the Northern Baptists. In 1947, another group split and formed the Conservative Baptist. In 1950, the Northern Baptist changed its name to the American Baptist Convention. And in 1972, they changed their name again to the American Baptist Churches USA. Now, the other thing you need to know about Baptists is that there are over 30 different groups of Baptists in America. There's the Bible Baptist Fellowship, the Southwide Baptist Fellowship, the American Baptist, the Southern Baptist, the General Association of Regular Baptists, the Conservative Baptist, the American Baptist Association, better known as Landmark Baptist, the Cooperative Baptist, which is a breakaway from the Southern Baptist, the Free Will Baptist, the National Baptist, which is the African American Baptist, the Primitive Baptist, the Reformed Baptist, and the Seventh-day Baptist, to name a few. All right. There were so many varieties of Baptists, you start asking, what makes you a Baptist? And the answer is, the Baptist hold. And it depends on who you ask. Some will say five things, some will say seven, some will say even fewer. But it comes down to the Bible is the final authority for faith and practice. That's a Baptist slogan. That baptism is for believers, not babies. and that the church is made up of regenerated people and separated from the state. So the separation of church and state is a big issue in the history of Baptist. All right, that's Baptist. Next on the list are Quakers. Now, there's not a whole lot to say about Quakers except in 1656, two Quaker women arrived in Massachusetts and they were promptly accused of being witches and were deported. When banishment failed, the governor ordered the death penalty. Three Quakers were hanged on the Boston Commons. Quakers settled in the colonies that had more freedom of religion, such as Rhode Island, New Jersey, and Maryland. When George Fox, the founder of the Friends, came to the 13 colonies, he found many Quaker groups were already there. In 1667, William Penn became a Quaker convert, and he, in 1682, he organized Pennsylvania on the basis of complete religious freedom and invited the oppressed religious groups of Europe to Pennsylvania. For 70 years, the governors of Pennsylvania were descendants of William Penn. Interesting. Quakers began to enforce strict discipline. Pleasure, music, art were prohibited. Sobriety, punctuality, and honesty were demanded. Dress was plain and speech was biblical. As a result, they won few converts and separate groups were formed and they eventually fizzled down to a small group. All right, the next group I want to talk about are the Lutherans. The Lutherans came late to America and small members, rather than were organized, smaller members came to America than other churches that were originated in Europe. So, from 1623, Lutherans from Holland conducted meetings in the Dutch colony of New Amsterdam, which was later named New York. In 1638, the first independent colony of Lutherans was established along the Delaware River in what is present-day Wilmington, Delaware. But for most of the Lutheran immigrants, they went to Pennsylvania. After the Civil War, many in the Midwestern cities found Lutheran churches there. At one time, there were 150 Lutheran bodies in the United States. They beat the Baptist. However, they started in the 20th century to consolidate, and they reduced the number to fewer than a dozen, so that today there are probably about 10 or even fewer groups of Lutherans. The oldest Lutheran denomination is the Missouri Synod, and then there is the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. So that's the Lutherans. Let's talk about the Presbyterians, moving right along. The Presbyterians in America sprang from two sources. One was the Presbyterian Church of Scotland, formed by John Knox, and the other was the Puritan movement in England. In 1720, a log cottage was organized in a cabin. I'm sorry, I said log cottage. Log college, not cottage, college, was organized in a cabin in Pennsylvania to train Presbyterian ministers and evangelists. Eventually, it became the College of New Jersey and later was renamed Princeton University. It produced revivalistic Presbyterian preachers who played a leading role in the Great Awakening in the 1740s, which we are going to get to shortly. They promoted an emotional new birth revivalism, which conflicted with creedal Calvinism. Presbyterians split over the issue. The old side opposed revivalism, while the new side endorsed it. The two sides quarreled with each other until they were reunited in 1757. The only clergyman to sign the Declaration of Independence was a Presbyterian named John Witherspoon. He was the president of Princeton Seminary. Like the Baptists, the Presbyterians split over slavery. The Presbyterian Church USA was founded in 1983. The Bible Presbyterian Church founded in 1938. The Cumberland Presbyterian Church in 1810. And the Orthodox Presbyterian Church in 1936. Most Presbyterians are... There's some liberalism in the Presbyterian Church, but they are... the more conservative Presbyterians are very Calvinistic, holding to the Westminster Confession of Faith and the larger and shorter catechism coming out of the Westminster Confession of Faith. All right, two more. The Methodist Church. So let's talk about the Methodist Church. John Wesley appointed Francis Ashbery and Thomas Coke as joint superintendents over the Methodist societies in America. At a conference in Baltimore, the American Methodist Society, contrary to Wesley's wishes, adopted the title the Methodist Episcopal Church, and Ashbery and Coke were made bishops. This amounted to a Declaration of Independence. American Methodism now stood on its own feet as a separate body. Coke returned to England. Ashbery, as bishop, was the head of the Methodist Church throughout the United States. Under his direction, Methodism was adapted to American rural settings. They had circuit-riding preachers on horseback traveling to the expanding frontier. They did a lot of evangelistic work. So the Methodists grew mainly because they were evangelistic. Now, later I'm going to mention the fact that they got so concentrated on evangelism, they sort of abandoned Wesley's view of entire sanctification. And as a result of them getting away from it, another group sprouted called the Holiness Movement. I'm going to get to that later. I just want to throw it in now. There's one other group I'd like to talk about, and it's the Disciples of Christ or the Christian Church. This denomination was formed from two movements. One by Alexander Campbell and the other by Barton Stone. And actually, this was supposed to be a restoration movement. They wanted to restore the church and unify Christianity. They had a slogan, Thomas Campbell. We speak where the Scripture speaks and remain silent when they are silent. Based on this concept, he eliminated traditional church practice, including the use of musical instruments in the church. So, he had a son named Alexander, and he began to practice baptism by immersion, actually joined a Baptist church, and was for a while a Baptist. He became leader of the movement. In 1830, he separated from the Baptists, and they were known as Disciples, the Disciples of Christ Church. Contrary to their original intent, they ended up formulating a new denomination, the Disciples of Christ. That was opposite of what they intended to do. Barton Stone was a Presbyterian pastor who was unable to accept the Calvinistic doctrine of total depravity and unconditional election. So he left the Presbyterian Church in 1804 and used the name Christian Church. In 1824, Campbell and Stone met for the first time and became steadfast friends. They both had publications, which I'll not go into, but in 1832, the Disciples Movement, led by Alexander Campbell, and the Christian Movement, associated with Stone, merged, forming the Disciples of Christ, also known as the Christian Church. Today, the official name of the church is the Christian Church, the Disciples of Christ. But the official name is the Christian Church. There were other Restoration churches named Churches of Christ. Pepperdine University is connected with the Churches of Christ. A year or so ago, I went to a conference there to hear a speaker. Pastor friend of mine said, hey, we need to go to this to hear the speaker. So we went. And all the music was a cappella. The Churches of Christ do not have instrumental music, and we're going to get to that subject later. All right. I simply started out saying that American church history starts with the denominations. And so we've covered the denominations. The next subject I'd like to cover real quickly is revivalism. You've all heard of the Great Awakening. And then there was the Second Great Awakening. If you know anything at all about American church history, you know about Charles Finney. All of this comes under the umbrella of revivalism. So I want to discuss the second topic under American history after denominationalism is revivalism. And I want to start the revivalism by talking about the Great Awakening. The one that's associated with the Great Awakening is Jonathan Edwards. But without going into a lot of detail, let me just tell you that it really started with a Reformed pastor in the Dutch Reformed congregation in New Jersey, who fervently preached and put an emphasis on conversion, the conversion with a heartfelt faith expressed in holy living. He emphasized a faith that could be felt and resulted in a sanctified life, but it was not emotionalism, but it was heartfelt. That's important. He influenced a Presbyterian pastor who became a fiery evangelist, and the revival started among the Dutch Reform and Presbyterian in the Millie colonies, but it spread to the Congregationalists in New England through the preaching of Jonathan Edwards. And he's the one that gets a lot of attention when it comes to the Great Awakening. Presbyterians from the middle colonies also carried the revival fires to the south. Now, today you don't think of revival in Presbyterian or Reform terms, and certainly not this heartfelt conviction and conversion. That sounds more like Baptist. But the Great Awakening was among the Congregationalist and Presbyterians and Reform. Now, to really understand Jonathan Edwards, you need to start with his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard. Stoddard is spelled S-T-O-D-D-A-R-D. Stoddard. Now, this gets a little confusing. Stoddard just wanted to see people saved. That was his motivation. He believed that conversion came through preaching, and he rejected the Puritan claim that no one could know for sure they were converted. He believed people could know they converted, and so he decided to use conversion as a converting ordinance. Now, this is so foreign to anything we're familiar with, this is going to sound strange. But there was something called the halfway covenant, meaning you could become halfway a member of the church. Now, here's what that amounted to. Children of non-professing Christians could be baptized, but they could not partake of the Lord's Supper. So, thus they were halfway church members. The halfway covenant was, if you're a child, you can be baptized, but you can't partake of the Lord's Supper. So you're halfway in. What Stoddard decided to do was claim that the Lord's Supper was a privilege reserved not for the regenerate, but as a means of salvation for the unregenerate. So he invited them all to come in and partake of the Lord's Supper. And unsaved people could take of the Lord's Supper because I want to convert you. Now I got you in church and I can preach to you and get you converted. Well, that was scandalous in that day. So he was called the first great revivalist in New England. The point is that there were unsaved people now in the church. He started a new trend. Well, his grandson, Jonathan Edwards, graduated from Yale and became the associate pastor of Northampton. This is in Massachusetts, Western Massachusetts. He became the associate pastor to his grandfather. And 2 years later, the grandfather, he became the pastor. So in December of 1734, Jonathan Edwards preached a series of sermons on justification by faith, during which he argued that sinners were to flee from the wrath of God. So Edwards' sermons were not emotional. They were careful expositions of a profound theological subject. But he did underscore the need for an experience of conviction of sin and forgiveness. Nevertheless, people began to respond with emotional outburst. During the following spring and summer, the town was said to be full of the presence of God. Edwards himself wrote in one of his books, "There was scarcely a single person in town, young or old, left unconcerned by the great things of the eternal world. Meetings were thronged." He also wrote, "Souls began to flock to Christ as the Savior in whose righteousness alone they hoped to be justified." There were the conversions of several people that really got attention. Now, I'm going to quote Edwards, all right? He said, "Especially a young woman considered to be one of the, quote, greatest company keepers in the whole town," end of quote. You get my drift. The local prostitute got saved. And she was a company keeper. And that caused a great stir. Within a year in Hampton alone, a town of 200 families, approximately 300 people were saved. By the next year, the revival, meaning conversions, spread to all kinds of towns in western Massachusetts. During the first year of the revival, more than 3,000 people were converted. Now, we have churches now that have 3,000 people in them, but you got to keep in mind, Northampton had, what, 200 families. That's the whole town. So what's that? You know, a family of four, 800 people? Maybe probably not that many. So 3,000 people is a lot of conversions. All right. By the way, I don't think I. Okay, let me go on. 1740, George Whitefield comes to Northampton. Now, he preached in other towns and cities in Massachusetts for a month. Once again, the fervor quickened, this time bringing, quote, manifestations even more bizarre than the earlier ones. People bewailed their sins aloud and groaned in fear and repentance. There were strong emotional and physical manifestations. Strong men fell as though they were shot, and women became hysterical. Edwards steadfastly defended revivalism. And revivalism is this emphasis on conversion that has a heartfelt and even emotional reaction. That's part of this whole revivalism. One author says that Sarah, that's Jonathan Edwards' wife, went to pieces in the month of January 1742. She experienced hallucinations, fainting spells, and sleepless nights. On January 29th, she woke up trembling with anxiety over the fact that someone else other than her husband was to speak in the church that morning. She was concerned that the speaker, a Mr. Williams, might have be a greater instrument for good than her husband. A lot of hysteria going on. Her husband believed that what she was experiencing was a theological crisis, which was part of the process of conversion. After this experience, she did not begin to. She did begin to live in the assurance of salvation that she didn't have to try to deserve. All right, in June 1541. Edwards preached a sermon entitled Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God in the church in Northampton. How many of you heard of the Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God? You heard of that sermon? You've never heard of that sermon? One of the most famous sermons in all of church history. All right. People in the church listened lethargically and unscathed by the sermon, and strolled outdoors to talk about the weather the sunshine would hold for the haying season. The next month, on July 8th, Edwards attended a conference in Enfield, Connecticut. When asked on short notice to preach, he dipped into his saddlebag and hauled out the sermon that he had preached in his own congregation the month before. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, that caused a ripple of reaction. This time, Edwards and his now famous sermon made homiletical history. People yelled and screeched. They rolled in the aisles. They crowded up into the pulpit and begged him to stop. One observer reported, one waited with the deepest and most solemn solitude to hear the trumpet sound and was deeply disappointed when the day terminated and left the world in its usual state of tranquility. One said, during his sermon he had to stop and request silence that he might be heard over the loud weeping. He read the sermon. But his earnest manner and prayer had a great effect on the people. Matter of fact, it was customary in those days to read the sermon. I'll mention that later in connection with something else. Jonathan Edwards was a key figure in the Great Awakening, but the major influence was George Whitefield. From 1738 to 1770, he made 7 preaching tours to America. He preached from New England to Georgia, and thousands of people were converted. At least 10% of the English population claimed to have been converted, but eventually the fires of the Great Awakening completely burned out. Jonathan Edwards said that between 1744 and 1748, his church was utterly dead. During those years, only one person was converted. The revival divided people. One side was called the old lights. The other side was called the new lights, led by Jonathan Edwards. The division eventually led to the development of a liberal group and an orthodox group among churches. Unitarians emerged out of the old lights and split off from the New England Congregationalists. Nevertheless, there were some unusual results. Out of a population of 300,000 in New England, between 30 and 40,000 were converted. And 150 new churches were established. Thousands came into the church in the middle and southern colonies. Colleges such as Princeton, King's, which is now called Columbia, Hampton, Sydney, and others were started to provide ministers for the new congregation. Mission work was increasing. For example, at great personal sacrifice, David Brainerd engaged in missionary work among the Delaware Indians in New Jersey. Many other humanitarian enterprises were started. The Great Awakening began in the Congregational and Presbyterian churches, but in the long run, it was the Baptist and Methodist who profited from it. At first, the Baptists opposed the awakening, calling it frivolous and superficial. But the awakening led many people to conclude that they, to the conclusion that were favorable to the Baptists. The experience of conversion raised doubts about infant baptism. And as a result, many Congregationalists and Presbyterians eventually rejected infant baptism and became Baptist, including entire congregations. The Great Awakening also led Baptists and Methodists to the Western frontier, where they established churches. Thus, the true groups became more numerous in the newly settled frontier. And when we say frontier, we're talking about Western New York and Ohio. We're not talking about Midwest or Western. All right, that's the first Great Awakening. Let's talk about the second Great Awakening. By 1789, the Great Awakening was largely dissipated, mainly by deism, brought to the colonies by the British Army officers during the French and Indian War, by importing deistic literature, and by the French Revolution. Gambling, profanity, vice, drunkenness were common among the students at Yale, who were proud of their infidelity. In 1879, Asbury, the Methodist bishop, created a unique method of evangelism by appointing the first circuit rider in New England. Soon there were circuit riders in all the New England states. In 1795, Timothy Dwight, the grandson of Jonathan Edwards, became president of Yale. In 1802, as a result of his lecture and chapel sermons, about one-third of the students were converted. From Yale, the revival spread to Dartmouth, Williams, and other colleges. In 1802, Yale had 230 students, and a third of them were converted. The Presbyterians were most influential in the revival on the frontier. They originated the camp meeting, and most famous of all was the Cane Ridge, Kentucky. By the way, I've heard of camp meetings all my life, and until I did all this research, I thought the camp meetings were started by the Baptists and the Methodists. They were started by the Presbyterians. Wow. In August 1801, 10,000 people showed up at this Cane Ridge, Kentucky camp meeting. It was marked by strange physical phenomena, such as falling, jerking, rolling, dancing, and barking. These are Presbyterians. Frontier revivalism was much more spectacular than the quiet spiritual awakening brought about by the preaching of the word in New England. The awakening became more emotional and less intellectual, to the point that eventually it became anti-intellectual. I read some of this stuff and I think we're almost bordering now on extreme Pentecostalism. That's revivalism. Because there were so few opponents to gathering, opportunities to gathering and celebrating, thousands showed up. Many, of course, came for spiritual reasons, but others came for gambling and carousing. Matter of fact, someone said, while some played and others drank, the pastors preached. A cynic of the awakening lady declared that at Cane Ridge, as many souls were conceived as were saved. Get my drift. Interesting. In many cases, the response to call to repentance was surprising and overwhelming. While some wept and others laughed uncontrollably, others trembled, and some ran about, and some even barked. By the way, I'm going to get to this way down the pike toward the end of the semester, but there's some of this kind of stuff going on in the last few years. You heard about the Toronto blessing? I mean, some of this extreme emotional reaction has taken place in the last few years. We'll get to that later. One of the results of the Second Great Awakening was division among churches. It indirectly helped the growth of a number of Unitarian churches in England. Of course, they split over, are you going to follow it or not follow it? The Unitarian churches opposed the Orthodox Christianity and revival movement. In 1825, with 125 congregations, the American Unitarian Association was formed. They held to the unity of God, the humanity of Christ, the goodness of man, salvation by character, and the immanence of God in the human heart. Another result of the Second Great Awakening was the improved morals on the frontier. Because of the revival, drunkenness and profanity were greatly reduced. In 3 years, over 10,000 joined Baptist churches just in the state of Kentucky. There were other results. It was during this period that the midweek prayer meeting became an important part of American Christianity. Between 1780 and 1830, in order to meet the need of more trained ministers, the Presbyterians and Congregationalists formed over a dozen colleges. In 1812, Princeton Seminary was found. Mission boards were established. In 1816, the American Bible Society was organized. And in 1825, the American Tract Society was founded. So, these are the Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening. I want to mention very quickly something about Charles Finney. Charles Finney was a lawyer who was converted in 1821 and became a revivalist. His meetings in Rochester in 1830 and 1831 gained attention. He became a pastor for a time in New York City, and later he became the president of Overland College in Overland, Ohio. He clashed with the Calvinists. Calvinists believed that revival was the sovereign work of the Spirit of God and therefore had to be prayed down from heaven. Finney taught that revival could be worked up. Calvinists believed that unregenerate man are unable to believe. Finney preached that faith was an act of the will. So he had what was called new measures, which included protracted meetings. So we're going to start now protracted meetings. We're going to meet every night for a week or 2 weeks or a month. Colloquial language in preaching, unseasonable hours for service, naming individuals in public prayer and sermon, and the anxious bench to which inquirers could come. He is called the pioneer of modern mass evangelism. I spent 13 years as an itinerant evangelist traveling around the country conducting evangelistic meetings. And when I started in 1966, I was invited to conduct a two-week meeting, which is at the very tailed end of a custom. They then got shortened to 1 week. But just prior to that, especially in the South, it was common to have two-week protracted meetings. An evangelist would buy a tent, go to small towns in the South, set it up, and everybody would come because it was the only social event in the town. There was no television, internet, movie theater, yada, yada, yada. So everybody came, and the evangelist could preach to unsaved people by the buckets full. All right, so he started those new measures. By the way, he was post-millennialist. He believed the churches of regenerate people would make an impact on society, and then the perfect millennial order would arise. There are not many of those anymore. I want to mention a couple of other things. One is the Fulton Street prayer meeting. This does not get a lot of attention. But on September 23rd, 1857, six people gathered at noon for a prayer meeting on Fulton Street in New York City. In 6 months, 10,000 meetings, prayer meetings at noon, were being conducted in New York City. Between 500,000 and 1 million people were added to the church as a result. So it was a prayer revival. And then, of course, after the Civil War, revivals, the nature of revivals changed to urban, organized mass evangelism conducted outside the church building in great public halls. This is the evangelism we know from Billy Graham. From 1873 to 1875, D.L. Moody conducted successful meetings in the British Isles. In 1886, he helped organize the Chicago Evangelistic Society, out of which came the Moody Bible Institute in 1899. Successor to Moody's new type of evangelism were R.A. Torrey, the founding pastor of the Church of the Open Door in downtown Los Angeles later, Gypsy Smith, Billy Sunday, and later, Billy Graham. Would you like to take a break? Get up and stretch. Don't go too far.